The Bob Murphy Show, episode 14.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone, Bob Murphy here coming at you with another solo episode. I am recording amidst the polar vortex that has come down to the Midwest because of, you guessed it, global warming. I'm not making that up, folks. That's the new theory. So as I get my tauntaun ready to go into the store later today, I thought, let me bang this episode out. And on the one hand, I kept going back and forth. You really recall what I need to do in January 2019, as I promised all of you, was to give an explanation of what was going on in my book, The Three Lads and the Lizard King, which I wrote for my son. And there really was a lot that I put into it. And I thought, you know what, but I don't want to have a 2-hour episode talking about what I did in this book. And there's a trade off. The longer it goes, the fewer of you are going to listen. So let me just go through and tell some of the big themes. But also, as I just walk through it here, I'll, you know, comment on items that jump out at me, like, oh, yeah, and what was going on here, that sort of thing. Sort of like if you watch the special features on a DVD, you know, you see a movie you like and you say, I want to hear the director sit there and talk through the whole movie. It's that sort of deal. So where this came from, as I say, is I wrote it for my son. So when he was younger, we used to take really long road trips driving. We lived in Nashville and driving down to my parents in Florida. And he would always want me to tell stories. And the stories typically involved him. So like when he was real little, like every story was him in a Mario world. Like he'd be in a race, you know, because he would play Mario Kart or games like that. And so the story would be very formulaic and predictable. Of just, you know, I'd be telling a story, but I would know exactly the kind of story he'd want it to be. And he would be the star and he would win the race. But it was more dramatic if, like, he fell behind and I would, you know, have to invent obstacles or reasons that he fell behind. And then, oh, but then he comes through and saves the day and, you know, wins the race, that sort of thing. And then one time, I don't remember what changed, but I was putting him down to bed one night and he said he wanted me to tell him a story. And I really just went all out for some reason. Like, I don't know, maybe I didn't have work to do that night or something, which would have been rare. And I just really thought about it. And it was a pretty long, drawn-out story. And it was, I sort of adapted the Lion King. Like, he actually was a lion. But, you know, the lion cub had his name. And so then he goes away. It's not that he, like, thought he killed his dad or anything. I mean, I wasn't completely ripping off the story. But the point was, what I had done with it is he went and was like out of commission. I know what I did. I flipped it around. It was the opposite of the Lion King. It was that his dad, like the big lion, the king lion, went away for some reason. Like he got sidetracked by something. And then my son's character was like on the home front trying to maintain order, but things were closing in and then he got caught by the bad guys. And so like it was a cliffhanger. And then, you know, and I could see my son was getting kind of anxious because, like, I'm really painting him into a corner in this story. And, like, the way I told it, like, you kind of forgot about where the dad lion was. Like, you know what I mean? I told that part of the story and then moved back to the local kingdom or village or whatever it was. And just, you know, the age he was at that point, if you haven't talked about something in 5 minutes, he probably kind of forgot about it. And so now it seems like the story and all the action is just happening in the village and you kind of forgot that the dad was still out there trying to get back. And so then when the bad guy's just about to, I don't know, throw him into lava or something, that I went. And then he heard, and I did a big growl. And then my son's eyes lit up because he remembered, oh, wait, the dad is still out there coming back. So anyway, since I got such a reaction out of him, even I telling the story was like, you know, that was a much better story than what I usually do. I thought, okay, why don't I, you know, instead of just banging these things out on the fly when he asked me at bedtime and I'm exhausted myself, why don't I go ahead and really think through and try to write something for him? So let me just say the outset in terms of I'm trying to remember, Like, what is, how do the order of these things get into the book? You know, what was something I knew from the beginning I was going to do versus little details that just occurred to me as I was actually writing it? Because there was that combination for those who have never written something, and I'm obviously not claiming I'm some master weaver of tales, but you sort of know it before you write it out. You have an idea of the big plot elements, but then as you go to do it, it's, you know, you have to invent things, and you see some little trick or whatever, like, oh, wait a minute, this detail can match it with this, and then you might even add something because you realize, oh, wait a minute, if this is true, then, you know, down the road in the story, this can happen, you know, that sort of thing. So it's hard to remember at this point, but I'm pretty sure the number one thing that occurred to me was I had been going to all these movies that were featuring huge battles. Like, in other words, like Lord of the Rings and almost any movie you could think of, these big epic battle scenes is how the movie would end, or at least that would be near the ending of the movie, of good versus evil. And it just keep that in mind when you go to movie theaters. And I think that might be more an American thing than a Homo sapiens thing, because I saw a movie one time about, it was like written by some Palestinian guy, and he had like this fantasy of like, if he had superpowers and how he would stand to the Israelis who are occupying his area in his framework. I'm not taking a stand on that right now for this episode, folks, so don't send me angry emails. But from his point of view, for sure, they were Israeli occupiers. And you would think if he gave himself superpowers, like, he would have vanquished them, but that's not what he did in the movie. So I don't want to spoil it or anything or go into it, but I was struck by, like, if there had been an American writing a movie about ejecting people, well, I guess, you know, that's Red Dawn. But that's my point, is that this idea of, you know, oh, there's good and evil, and then what happens is there's a big battle at the end of the story and the good guys win. You know, that's pretty typical. And I think that's more of a American movie thing, I guess you could say. Well, it's also British, because that's what was happening in those British fiction that I was alluding to also. But point is, that seems to happen a lot. And it's even in children's literature. So Chronicles of Narnia, for example, right? That they're the kids. I mean, it's wonderful. The kids go through the wardrobe and they end up as part of a big adventure, but they're in a big war. All right. And I believe me, I understand the rationale for that, but I'm just saying that I thought, okay, I want to do something where the moral does not end up being that, oh, there's bad people out there, and if you, you know, face your fears and rise to the challenge, you too can go kill them just like the other heroes. That seemed odd to me that was so often the lesson that we were teaching children. So, by the way, don't misconstrue what I'm saying. It's not like I'm upset about that. It wasn't that I was saying, hey, we should stop doing that. It was more, I want to do something where that's not the moral. So what I'll say at the outset is, throughout the book, you will see that the main characters will have an idea, right? That's the way they solve problems. It's not, oh, let me see how I can inflict further violence on this person or superior firepower. It's think through something, and an idea might occur to you, and you know, and don't give up. That's obviously also the big picture on this, and don't abandon your friends. All right, so I'll cut to the chase and say those are the lessons that you're supposed to take away from this. In general, I think those who agree with the libertarian philosophy should be encouraged and feel free to be creative in different outlets. As I've said in several places, we don't need more books. I mean, we could use more books, but that's not the critical thing that we lack. That right now, we're always fighting an uphill battle, that we're encountering people that just, quote, know how the world works, and emotionally they are equipped to approach it a certain way. And it's very difficult to make libertarian points in that sort of context. And so I think that, at least for those who could go either way with it, it's probably more important to lay a firmer foundation on the ethics or the emotional goodness, let's say, of the libertarian philosophy. And so what I mean there is, for example, like, just think about Charles Dickens novels, right? Like what he does there. And I don't like that because what he does in those novels is he has good guys and bad guys. And often the bad guys are rich people or businessmen. Okay. So I think it's hard when people grew up with stories like that. It's hard then to say, but let me write a booklet that you read for the first time when you're a junior in college, talking about why profit-seeking businessmen and women allocate resources to the where they're most urgently needed. You know, like if somebody either trying to use their mind to bat down what their emotional gut instinct is, because when they were young, you know, their value system was formed by people who at least emotionally were socialists. Okay. So that's what I'm saying is I think that trying to form stories that have heroes that exemplify traits that are compatible with libertarianism is an important thing to do. So let me be clear. I am not 100%. I am not saying go write a libertarian novel or go write a libertarian song or go make a libertarian movie. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying go write a great novel, a beautiful song, a really exciting, fun movie that happens to have libertarian themes in it. Okay, so that's what I mean. Just like if you watch a Christmas Carol production, all right, and it's got Ebenezer Scrooge and da-da-da, like it doesn't come out and tell you, hey, the worker should control the means of production. Right. But you get what I'm saying, that attitude is what primes people to think businessmen are evil. Or I guess I was going to say that when I was growing up, there was this cartoon called Captain Planet. And that was pretty much over the head. But that's also why it wasn't very good. Right. That a lot of people don't even know what Captain Planet, the cartoon, is, whereas lots of people know the work of Dickens. So. And another thing, too, is just it's far more memorable when you tell things in a story. And I've noticed even in my economics writing lately, I'll make my generic point, but the way to really drive it home, or the other way around, if what I'm talking about is a really dry topic, like recently I was writing something for the Laura Murphy Report involving life insurance and, you know, how does mortality affect the internal rate of return on the cash value of a whole life policy, right? So it's not exactly riveting stuff. And so the way I motivated it and tried to keep the reader from nodding off was I had two different guys. One was healthy Hank and the other was sickly Sam. And healthy Hank only had a 10% chance of dying each year and sickly Sam had a 50% chance of dying each year. And then I went through and did the numbers. Da, da, da. Okay, so I'm just saying, you know, why do I find the need to do that? Or just in general, for those of you who know my what's been called the sushi article of showing the importance of capital, there, I didn't just make generic points about, oh, well, there's higher orders of capital goods, and if you don't have proper maintenance, and what happens during the artificial boom is people expand the higher order sectors at the expense of the middle, as we can see in the Hayekian triangle. And I mean, yeah, that's good for perhaps an academic lecture, but in terms of writing something down and why does certain things stick, I think the part of the reason that one did and why people call it the sushi article is that I told a little story and it involved Paul Krugman, right? So you have to have a villain and he gets washed up on an island and gives the villagers really bad advice about how they should start running their economy, and their main consumption good in that world is rolls of sushi. All right. And so I tell a story that way. And a lot of people have told me like, oh yeah, your sushi article, that was like one of the best ones I ever read from you. Okay. So what's my point is that putting stuff into the form of a story, it makes it much more memorable and people are equipped to understand it better. I read something, it would be a better anecdote if I could remember the exact details, but it was something assessing your ability to understand conditional probability. And you know, so they would have a generic test for people to see if they understood, like, oh, if you see this bit of information, then you can conclude such and such. And, you know, it was that kind of a mental task. And what they found is the people did very poor on it when it was abstract. But when they put the same reasoning in the form of a story and said, you're a bouncer at a bar, these are the rules about who's allowed to come in, if someone walks up to the door to you and shows you such and such, you know, should you let them in or not? And everybody easily gets it in that context, right? So it's like people are equipped to be on the lookout for someone trying to scam them, and they can understand an invalid argument if it's presented in the form of a story with someone, you know, who has an agenda that might not be the same as yours, and you're trying not to be a sucker, right? So there, it works well. I remember Lou Rockwell one time said something like, oh, yeah, well, people are very interested in monetary policy when they learn that the Fed's ripping them off, because that's very interesting to know someone's ripping you off. Okay, I'm paraphrasing, but he said something like that, and I laughed, and it's true. It is interesting. And that's why if I have to go talk to a crowd, if I'm allowed to talk like that, because in certain venues, you know, that would just seem conspiratorial or whatever. Hey, we're trying to keep it academic here, Dr. Murphy. Can you just explain the mechanics of things without being ideological? Right. So that can be real dry if you're talking about Federal Reserve policy in that context. But if I'm allowed to talk about, you know, the motivations and why did they do this interest on reserves rule? Well, the official reason is this. But on the other hand, notice how they're funneling billions of dollars to bankers now. That's interesting. If I could talk like that, people don't nod off because, you know, you're letting them in on a little secret. And hey, look what these people are doing to you over here. Okay. So all this is to say that telling stories, I think, is a much underappreciated way of getting these ideas out. That's also what happens in a song, right? That I'm sure you can think of many memorable songs, you know, like Jim Croce, "You Don't Mess Around with Jim," right? Once you hear that, okay, boom, you remember that for the rest of your life, the characters that are built up in certain songs. So last examples I'll give you here in terms of teaching lessons or morals through songs. The obvious example is Jesus with parables, right? The Good Samaritan. Everyone knows that phrase. Interestingly, I think a lot of modern people don't realize that he wasn't saying Good Samaritan just as like an extra bit of information, that in the context of when he was telling that, the Samaritan was not someone that the Jewish listeners would have liked. And so it was a double irony that all the officially good people, religious leaders and whatever, were walking past the guy who was beat up on the road, and it was the Samaritan who stopped and helped him. What about the boy who cried wolf, right? We all know what that means. Or the emperor has no clothes, and the boy who called that out. Right? These stories that stick with us, once you hear it, you understand what it is and it's trying to get across. Another one I loved growing up, and I don't know if this was because I came from an Irish household and these were the things that were stressed. I sometimes ask people, and some have heard it and some haven't, but the story, there's a someone's hunting for a leprechaun, and he's going over the hill, and he finally finds the leprechaun, and the leprechaun's asleep, and he goes up and catches him. And this is an unheard of thing. And it's well known that if you catch a leprechaun, he has to tell you where he's hidden his pot of gold. Okay. And so the leprechaun says, you got me. And he says, okay, I definitely have to tell you where my pot of gold is. And you know, I can't lie. Like, this is a rule. This is sacred to the leprechauns. And if you get caught by a human, you got to tell him honestly where the pot of gold is. And the guy says, okay. And he says, well, it's up over several hills ahead. So tell you what, you let me go and I will go and I will tie a gold ribbon around the tree where my pot of gold is buried under. And, you know, you know I'm going to do that because you know that I can't lie on something like this. And so the guy says, okay. And so he lets the leprechaun go. But of course, the leprechaun's very crafty. And so the kid's walking and he goes up over the one hill, he goes up over the next hill, and he comes to the top and he looks and he's horrified to see that there are thousands of trees in sight and every single one of them has a gold ribbon tied around it. All right. And so obviously the leprechaun didn't lie, but he misled the kid. And so he still hid where his gold was. So that kind of a story, that's a cute little thing. But again, just stressing the, for those from Ireland, like that, the fact that they're mascot or whatever you want to call it is very clever and crafty. Like that's something that would, you know, if they're telling those stories and those are the, not necessarily hero, but that's the sort of thing like just, okay, so now you realize you got to be on your guard and, you know, don't let somebody outsmart you. Don't make the same mistake that guy did. All right. I read a story of a mobster who had, you know, turned state's witness. I forget the guy's name right now, but he was saying how when he grew up, his father told him a story and they all would teach these stories to their kids about the gangster back in Sicily or whatever that takes his kid and the kid goes, he takes him on a fairly high ledge, and the father's on the ground, you know, standing on the bottom on the ground, and he says, "Go ahead and jump, and I'll catch you." And the kid's little, and he goes, "No, I don't want to, Daddy." He goes, "Go ahead, jump, I'll catch you." He goes, "I don't want to, Daddy." He goes, "Go ahead, jump." And so the kid jumps, and the father doesn't do anything and lets the kid smack into the ground. And he goes, "See, don't trust anybody." Right? So that, and like, that's the lesson. He's being a good dad and teaching his kid that. Okay, so my point is, those different stories, you can see how that would affect how you grow up and the sort of person you turn into. So that's, again, my last plea here before we dive into the details of trying to encourage you to craft your worldview. If you have any sort of creative talents, artwork as well. I'm such a poor drawer. I can't even, you know, extrapolate and talk about, well, gee, I imagine if I were a really great painter, you know, what would I do with that? Like, it's, so I'm not neglecting that on principle. It's just that I can't comment on that at the moment. Okay, so I'm just going to go through and comment on a few things that jump out at me from the book for those who've read it and it may not have jumped out at them. Incidentally, let me just say, if for some reason you're listening to this and you haven't gotten the book yet, I would strongly encourage you to get the book. So it's at bobmurphyshow.com/lizard. And you're allowed to stop this podcast right now and you can come back to it. That's the beauty of it. It's not like you're listening to me live. Okay, so the kids, when they encounter the tombstone on page 2, it said, "Here lies John Casey's children's author in a smashing good time." So there, that was an homage. I just changed the guy's last name a little bit, but I retained the J-O-N spelling just as an extra hint for those who are familiar with the guy. So he's this children's author, and my son and I were reading some of his stuff at the time, and our favorite one was this book called Smash Crash. And it was just, it's a silly little story, but it really drove home for me how children's authors have different levels of talent. And what I mean by that is that we read the Smash Crash book and it was fun and it was kind of trippy, right? So if you have a little kid who might be interested in a story about trucks and cars that are alive and talking, besides obviously the classic movie Cars, get this book, Smash Crash, and see what you think of it. But it's kind of crazy. Like, it's hard to make sense of it. It's almost like I think this guy was stoned when he wrote the story or something, but it's a good story. And then we got the follow-up that was written by somebody else, and it was terrible. And I know that sounds funny, but that's partly what I'm getting at, that if to you, you're thinking, it's just a kid's book, who cares? No, there's really a difference. You can tell that, you know, the one that was written by the original guy who is an award-winning child's author, and then the one that the company obviously just said, well, let's get another one because that first one sold well. We could probably crank out another one. It's, you know, sort of like the when the sequel's done, not by the original creator. And then on this scene too, I had the boys play with like taking a stick and putting it in and then throwing rocks in there through the glowing tombstone, just because I always would get frustrated in other stories or movies where the people would discover some sort of power and they wouldn't like do scientific experiments, if you will, like with Wolverine. And I think somebody told me once they got into this in the comics, but you know, in the Marvel universe, like that stuff happens with Wolverine, like where he regenerates or whatever. And like, well, why don't they try cutting him in half and seeing, does he turn into two Wolverines or what? You know, who knows? All right. There's my explanation of what's going on there, that I thought these kids, if they were smart, they would sit there and play with this new phenomenon they had discovered a little bit before they would literally dive into it. The other thing you discover at this point on page 4 is that John is sort of the hothead of the group, and he's always going, woo, he's diving forward. And so that's his strength and his weakness, right? So he is the leader of the group. And incidentally, when I wrote the story originally and gave it to my son, the three names of the boys were different. One of them was my son's name. One was his best friend. And then the other one was a generic name I made up. All right. So two of the characters were my son and his friend. And then I, you know, changed it to different names in this book. Obviously, David is a reference to King David, you know, being able to beat Goliath. And the other ones, there wasn't too much thought, but John just seemed like a nice sturdy name for a strong person who's kind of a hothead and a natural leader, right? When they get into the other realm, the reason I had the people talking with the formal language is I wanted to reinforce that these kids were in a foreign land, but obviously, you know, I couldn't convey to the reader, oh, and everyone had a funny accent or something like that. So that's why I just have the people in this world talking in such formal tones. That was the best trick I could come up with or device in order to remind the reader that these kids are in a different world right now. Because I wanted to keep the book short also. And so I didn't want to spend a lot of time with flowery language describing the vistas and the architecture and but so I thought, okay, I can keep it pretty short and snappy, but remind you that you're in this foreign realm if the people are speaking in this sort of odd sentence structure. Okay, the device with, you know, why are they shocked to see David's hair? Well, my son at the time, I mean, he still has red hair, but at the time his hair was like shockingly red. Like people in grocery stores would come up to us and remark on my son's hair. And so, again, since the story is about him and he's the star of the story, that was just an interesting way to make it more like, no, this is really about you, right? Like this is a story about stuff happening to you. And also, too, I mean, this is obvious, but I'll just go ahead and say it for the to be official. So what's so great about these types of stories, you know, you see it, Chronicles of Narnia, Harry Potter, you know, that kids who are, you know, bored or they're unhappy about stuff, but then to learn like, oh, what if you went to a different world where you're really important, right? And so that that's the common element in all those stories. I mean, it's probably the most obvious in Harry Potter, the contrast, because, you know, his life is so horrible when he's in the regular world. And so here, that's the idea that the boys go through the grave and they're in this other world. And then they quickly learn that, wait a minute, there's this prophecy and everybody's waiting for them to show up and they have people knowing they're just really important. All right. So you can understand why that would be something that would resonate to little kids hearing the story. Okay. The stuff about when the prophecy with, oh, and you have morsels of tasty delight. I'm pretty sure what happened there was I wanted the story to start out with Halloween just because when I was growing up, I always thought Halloween was awesome. And I don't mean just dressing up. I mean, that was fine too. But I just mean for some reason, like it being spooky and you're out at night and whatever. And that was just my favorite time of the year. And I think it has to do with this, you know, the backdrop. Oh, if it's good versus evil. And that's sort of what's going on in Halloween. And if you're thinking you're a defender of the realm, you know, you got to be on your guard on Halloween walking around at night because, you know, the ghouls are out, like that sort of thing. So that's what I was trying to get at in the beginning. So then given that, then the kids are going to have Halloween candy on them. And then, you know, I had the idea about the wolf creatures guarding the gray dye. That's going to happen a little bit. And so realizing, oh, wait a minute, I can tie that in. Like, how are they going to get by those creatures? Because, you know, the gray dye had to be guarded. There had to be an intermediate puzzle to solve before going right to the Lizard King. And so that was the reason for that plot device. So I'm pretty sure, you know, I had decided first there's going to be Halloween, and I knew that, of course, much earlier this great eye was going to be there to give them their gifts. And then I think I would just said, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, they can get by these wolves if they have candy, and hence the morsels of tasty delight. Because, again, the prophecy has to involve these kids completing their mission. It's a little thing, but on page 11, as I was rereading this to get ready for this podcast, I really did like this part where Michael says to the guy who's escorting them to where the great eye is, Michael says, so how do we talk to the eye? And then says, the man chuckled. I admire your humble spirit. Do not be ashamed of your destiny. We have always known you lads would arrive and receive your gifts of power from the great eye. I have brought you here, but can help you no more. Okay, so what's going on there is, you know, number one, the kids have to figure out how to get by the creatures themselves, and the villagers, you know, they don't know. But also just showing that guy's like humble faith, right? That he heard the prophecy. He believes in the prophecy. The kids don't believe in the prophecy right now. They just think this is kind of an adventure. And they honestly don't know how are we supposed to do this? And yet he knows that they will. And so I think that's an important lesson. So even in a secular context, you know, if you just have confidence and have faith that things will work out, they do. And it doesn't mean you know ahead of time how it's going to work out. Okay. So think about like a show like Doctor Who. If I've been watching a lot of that with my fiance lately, you think about a show like Doctor Who, what's great about it is like just about every episode, he almost dies. He almost fails and he always comes through, or in some episodes he doesn't. And there's got to be a to be continued. And so the point is like, it's, that's what makes it good, that he doesn't know, but he does know over time that, you know what, I'm really quick on my feet and I'll come up with something. So he's confident, but that's not because he knows from the beginning exactly what he's going to do to beat the bad guy that episode, but he's confident that he'll come up with something. And so that's the kind of thing I was trying to inculcate with this story. And obviously if you're religious, then you know, you have faith that God is sovereign and he's good. And so therefore the story is going to unfold well. Let me just mention, because it occurs to me, reading the Harry Potter series, that was something that I really thought J.K. Rowling was, you know, trying to get across, was showing just how much angst Harry has going through school, and just how hilarious it is that he's worried about, oh my gosh, I got to go to the dance next week, or I'm going to flunk this class, or I got to do this thing. And meanwhile, Voldemort is building up his army. And, you know, as the reader, that ultimately in book seven, there's going to be the big showdown and that presumably Harry's going to win even before you get to that part. And yet Harry's sitting here freaking out over whatever, you know, because he did bad on his test in Snape's class or something. And so I think that's, you know, put it this way, if Harry could know that he was actually the star of a story that was written by somebody who was good and wanted good things for him and wanted good to ultimately conquer and thought that good was stronger than evil, if he knew he was in the tender hands of an author with that character, I mean the author's character, like I don't mean a fictional character, I mean the, you know, value system, that sense of character, then Harry presumably would calm way down and he would know, oh, everything's going to be okay. Bad things are still going to happen. His friends might die. Right. So Harry, his godfather, Sirius, could still die. You know, that does happen. But yet, in the grand scheme of things, everything works out in the Harry Potter series, right, in a certain sense. And Harry certainly shouldn't be freaking out over, you know, what he's going to wear to the dance next week, that kind of thing. All right. So likewise here, that's partly what I was trying to convey in this story as well. Okay. So when they get their gifts of power here, and you know, anticipating the end of the story, but it's, I wanted it to be different from the normal thing. And so I did not want it to be that the person with the most strength is the hero. And so that's why I have it that David's the one that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, he chose most wisely by having the gift of healing, because that's, for one thing, that's a really smart thing to have. Even if you're just on a conventional military campaign, you do need medics, but also that's obviously what allows him to defeat the Lizard King. And notice here too, that the specific wording of the prophecies saying that, you know, they shall cause the destruction of the Lizard King, not they shall kill the Lizard King. Okay. So it's sort of like that leprechaun story, but now in the hands of good. And I'll just say it here to make sure I don't forget. But later the Lizard King himself gets a prophecy from the Great Eye. Obviously, I don't think I need to tell you guys why did I pick a Great Eye, because it's all seeing. And, you know, there it wasn't wrong, but it was misunderstood. And also too, the good people, the townsfolk or whatever, they misunderstood what the prophecy was also. Okay, they would have thought quite understandably that what these boys were going to do was go and take their swords and go kill the Lizard King in a conventional battle. And that's not what happens. But the prophecy still is correct. So I love stuff like that. Another classic example in the New Testament, that some of the devout Jews think that Jesus can't possibly be the Messiah, because everybody knows the Messiah comes from Bethlehem, you know, from the prophecies, and Jesus is some guy who came from Nazareth, right? And so if you know anything about it, you realize why that's funny, because Jesus actually was born in Bethlehem, but he grew up in Nazareth, right? So little things like that, I just love. And so that's what I wanted to make sure ended up in this story. And again, here the context is, or the form of that, is that the prophecy says these boys will cause the destruction of the Lizard King. And yet people misunderstand that, both the quote good people and the bad people misunderstand what that means. when it comes to the fiat note stuff, I don't think I need to dwell too long on that for you guys. But my favorite part of this interaction is when they're looking at the note and it's got the Lizard King on it. And David says, "What the heck is that? This is a 20 fiat note," explained the metalsmith. "Many cycles ago, the Lizard King was just a man, a regular king. He put his face on our money. It was only later that we realized he was a lizard." And lizard has a capital L. So obviously I'm referring to the fact that on our money, we have pictures of presidents. And at the time, you know, people might have thought they were great or whatever. And we sort of revere them. And, look at these forefathers. And but, you know, what are you trying to say, Bob? So let me just take a moment now as I'm talking about it, this idea of lizard people. So I picked that partly just because it seemed very appropriate, you know, a lizard king. Like, everybody knows a person who's a reptile, that's not a good thing, and that's not somebody you should trust. And that's interesting. Like, why is it that in nature, in the Lion King, the Disney Lion King movie, you notice how the animals get grouped in certain ways, right? Like, the lions are good and the hyenas are bad. Now, why is it? Why is it so natural that or serpents are ones that you got to be real careful around? You know, the Jungle Book, for example. Right. So why is it? Doesn't that seem interesting that there's certain animals that you just, quote, naturally can group according to whether they're good or bad or trustworthy? So that's just interesting that, you know, that's out there. And so I don't want to dwell on that right now. And presumably it's not that in nature, like, hyenas actually go out and often swindle people is what I'm getting at, right? That in a sense, that doesn't really mean anything. But yet we all kind of see why it's natural that in The Lion King, the lions are the ones, you know, who are sort of noble, at least when it's done right. And, you know, why did C.S. Lewis pick a lion to be Aslan, right? So as far as the lizard idea here, at the very least, so it depends here what your, I guess, metaphysical views are. So if you're a believer in, you know, the Christian Bible, then I think it's clear you believe that there's God and there's the devil and there's angels and demons and people can be influenced by demonic spirits, and there's what's called spiritual warfare. And so when people are doing horrible things, especially people like in positions of power, and they end up doing things that are horrifying, and, you know, for a Christian, it would be no problem to say, oh yes, that person, you know, is being blinded by demonic influence. Okay. And different Christians would have different explanations for, well, what do you mean by that? You know, and it could be something very antiseptic and conceptual and just abstract, like, oh, I just mean they were tempted by power, you know, or they were seduced by the dark side, as, you know, you might say in the Star Wars universe. Okay. And so that's all we really mean by that. Or they could be quite literal and think, like, no, there's this being with a personality that's influencing your thoughts directly and, you know, goading you into doing evil things, right? So I'm not here taking a stand on that, but I'm just mentioning that. And just more generally, obviously people are aware of this idea of lizard people or whatever and the They Live movie and things like that. And so, again, it can run the spectrum of, I think what makes sense here is that if there were people like that, you could see why you couldn't trust them. In other words, if the governments of the world were run by these people, and let's call them lizard people, we'll be agnostic for them, what does that mean? But in other words, they would view themselves as being distinct from the people over whom they were ruling. Okay. And so that's why you could make a lot more sense of what happens, that, yeah, it's, you know, they really view themselves as a different category of being. And so therefore the stuff they do is not so shocking, just like the farmer has no problem doing particularly cruel things to his animals, not like because he's a sadist, but just because, well, no, I mean, what do you expect me to do with a chicken, you know, when the time comes, that sort of thing. On this note, let me mention, I'll link to it in the show notes page. So again, this is BobMurphyShow.com/14. There's a famous Jim, well, I don't know how famous it is, but in certain circles, people know about where Jim Carrey goes on the Jimmy Kimmel show. and he does this Illuminati, but he changes like to Illuminati or something sign. And it looks like it's a big gag, but yet I wonder if he's actually trying to let people know, like he's trying to go both ways with it, you know, and let people know, hey, I'm in on this and this is the most I can do to let you folks know what's going on. I have to play it off like I'm just making a big joke for obvious reasons, because if I didn't, you know, the networks wouldn't even show it, number one, but also, you know, for his personal safety. So he could be doing that, or he could just be cracking a joke. And so that's what I loved about it, is that I'll put a link to it, like I say, at BobMurphyShow.com/14, in case you don't know what I'm talking about, just to see. And so that's what I think with a lot of things like this reference to lizard people, you can kind of take it both ways, right? That, you know, for those who are Christian and really know stuff, saying, yes, you know, I am referring to spiritual warfare, but if other people, if they don't know, you know, you can just interpret it as, well, there is this, we all recognize people are tempted by evil in some way, and whether you want to just be abstract about it, okay, fine. So that's sort of the part of what's going on here with the Lizard King references, is that, you know, some people are just going to think, oh, yeah, it's a bad guy in a story, and other people are going to say, no, this has to do with spiritual warfare. And again, the point, what started me off on this tangent is, think of it, in this world, these people are battling this Lizard King, and yet the money they use features his face. And David says, so why do you still use his picture as your money? The Lizard King is very old, said the metalsmith. This is the only money I've ever known. All right, and to me, that's like the critical thing in fiat money today. It's not so much that people made a conscious, rational decision for one or the other, just people grew up in this system, and everyone is used to using it, so it must be right. Incidentally, that's part of the reason, like when the TSA came in after 9/11 and totally revamped airport security, I remember thinking, this is a shame, because my son was really little at the time, thinking this is a shame because my son's going to grow up in a world thinking it's totally normal, you know, to take your belt and shoes off and empty your bag out and everything, and to go through this intricate screening process. He's just going to think, oh, yeah, that's what you do when you get on an airplane. Duh, everyone knows that, because he's been doing it his whole life, not realizing that, no, up until the day before September 11th, 2001, that wasn't normal, and, you know, things had been fine up till then. I don't think I need to mention to you guys what's going on with the inflationary catastrophe that the boys put upon the city. But again, going back to what I was saying at the beginning of this episode, I think for a lot of people, they can understand it in the setting of a story. Like, oh yeah, if kids were going around being the fun guys in town, creating money left and right, that would eventually make prices go up and it would cripple the town. So I'm hoping the average reader wouldn't think I was just stopping to give a lecture. And I realize at times, those are the parts of the story where I flirted with that boundary line, and perhaps it did turn into preaching when that wasn't my intention. But was trying to, again, also just show in terms of picking the gifts that, you know, the one kid wants to be strong, the other guy is healing, and then this guy wanted to just create money and to show that the specific nature of his gift was not the best one. And so, you know, more generally, yeah, it's a subtle thing of me saying you don't want to have as your number one goal the acquisition of money, that's futile. That's not going to get you what you want. Having said that, though, notice I'm not taking an anti-capitalist spin. So unlike Charles Dickens, I then follow up with Michael gets to redeem himself. And I've been, by the way, that's what I was thinking. Like, I really did want Michael to be able to redeem himself. And so he does it here. And then later on, he does it by creating the ropes also to show the difference between commodity money and fiat money. And commodity money is actually useful for things. And so that's one important difference. And so here in the beginning of chapter 7, they're coming up with a way to use David's gifts in order to raise money. And so I'm showing there's nothing wrong with that. But Michael also realizes the benefits of marketing. That in the beginning, the people just don't believe it and they can't get the word out. And so then Michael starts, you know, with the huckster stuff and step right up, get your aches, illnesses, and injuries cured. Come on, folks, don't be shy. Be bold. Got a cough, got a cold, broke a bone, have the flu, just a touch from the amazing David, and you'll feel brand new. And even that isn't enough. People are just kind of chuckling. And so then he says to John, start throwing me way up in the air. And so then John does that, and that gets everybody's attention. Whoa, what the heck is this? They can't believe these kids can, you know, are so strong. And that's good. And then he heals somebody, David does, and then everyone flocks and brings in their money. So that's how they get through that next puzzle or log jam roadblock, is that they couldn't come up with the money, and so they have to come up with a way to earn money in order to go on their quest. And so that's what they do. So notice it combines all the powers of the kids. That's another thing I was trying to do, that I don't like it when there's superhero movies or other movies where people have powers and they just use them individually. My favorite is when they all do things together that combine their powers. So like the first Incredibles movie, at the end of that, they did that. It wasn't like blow your mind awesome level of combination of using their powers, but they did use their powers together. And you know, the one old guy, he's like, that's what they call old school or something. And that's what they're getting at there. They're trying to show. In other words, if you were in charge of the Justice League or the Avengers, you would probably screw it up, right? Like if you and your friends all just had their powers all of a sudden, you would not do nearly as well out in the battlefield as the actual Avengers of the Justice League, right? Because it's not just they individually have their powers, but they know how to fight together. They're a team. At least when the writers know what they're doing. Okay, so the part where John falls in the quicksand and then gets out, I've mentioned there, I'm showing you the benefits of commodity money as opposed to fiat money. And on page 36, though, this is one of my favorite parts of the story, where this guy Lewis, and by the way I spelled that is because I'm doing homage to C.S. Lewis, right? So it's the two children's authors that were weighing on my mind at the time. And so I was trying to give homage to them in this story. So that's why I spell Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, as opposed to the more conventional spelling. And so he says, Lewis looked at John, who was once again riding a little ahead of the group, even though his foolishness had earlier plunged him into the quicksand. The more Lewis studied the lad, the more ridiculous the whole situation became. The very idea that three young lads would swoop in from another world, and even though they had done nothing to earn it, the great eye would bestow upon them extraordinary gifts of power. Lewis and his most dedicated men had spent many, many cycles fending off attacks from the Lizard King, protecting the residents of their town. And now, because of some absurd prophecy, these three lads would vanquish the Lizard King and achieve immortal honor. It was all so unfair. And that's when he pulls his sword out and he's going to stab him in the back. And so what I was doing there is I wanted to make it real. I didn't want to just have on the outside and, oh, the guy takes out his sword and he's about to go hurt the little kid and then say, oh, the Lizard King did it. I wanted to get inside his head and to show how could the Lizard King possibly have taken this hero and flipped it so he wants to attack the kid, you know, who he's in charge of protecting. And so, you know, the angle I came up with is, you know, what could possibly irritate this guy? What could make him do that? Someone with such honor. And then I thought, okay, if he's a man of honor, then his weakness is probably he likes glory. And so it's not fair that, you know, they put on the work and they're this disciplined. And then this kid, this punk kid who comes in is going to get the glory and not him. Right. So that was the angle I took. And this naturally feeds into how does the Lizard King operate? So I'm on page 46 right now. This is the Lizard King talking to him. With grown-ups, it's very easy for me. They have lived a long time and experienced all sorts of cruelty and lying. Grown-ups know that all the things they were taught when they were little about being good boys and good girls is a bunch of garbage. This fills them with fear, jealousy, and hate, all the things I need to make them do whatever I want. But with kids, the Lizard King said, shrugging his shoulders, I got nothing to work with, you know? All right, so there's a couple things going on there. Number one, I had to just explain in terms of the plot. Why is it the Lizard King can influence grown-ups but not the three heroes of the story? And so, you know, I had to just say he can't take over the minds of kids. But then, you know, as I'm working through it, why would that be? And say, oh, okay, because, again, the way you're actually going to get grown-ups to do bad things is you draw on all their pain and suffering and cruelty that they've seen throughout their lives, which has made them bitter and callous. And that's, you know, that's where it comes. That's what he works with. All right. And so that's the sense in which I think it's true when you have an idea that kids are innocent and then they get corrupted as they grow older. Or put it to you this way, as bad as somebody's going to be, or as bad as people can be, put it that way, the worst ones are going to be adults, right? Like if you took some, you know, evil dictator who's killing thousands of people, he was probably not a good kid when he was 15, but he probably wasn't as bad as he was when he's 45, right? So in other words, if you're going to go down that the dark side path, just the older you get, the further down that path you're able to go, okay? So put it to you that way. Having said all that, of course, even kids have the capacity for evil, and I think that's partly what's going on in the Christian narrative. Before that scene, though, I just want to mention something. I really wanted to make it clear that I wasn't trying to champion violence in this. So earlier, you know, David says, are we going to have to kill people? Because my dad says violence only makes things worse. And then, you know, he's told that, well, in your world, maybe your father's wisdom is true, but here the Lizard King has performed unspeakable cruelties, or, you know, I'm paraphrasing. And so there what I'm trying to do. So I am a pacifist, in case you didn't know that. And so I did want to make it clear. And that was my way in the story of reminding my son and the casual reader that I personally am a pacifist, that I'm saying violence only makes things worse. And you can see, but I also understand, you know, I'm not stupid or naive. I get why most people think, oh, come on, that doesn't work. Yeah, that'd be nice if it did. But no, right now, did you see what these people did? We need to stop them and we need to use guns. And so that's what I'm getting at there. And so here the story progresses, and it's not even as if David objects. He's okay letting John say, don't worry, I got this. I'm the strongest guy alive. But ultimately, as we'll see, it wasn't violence that defeats the Lizard King in the end. The Lizard King destroys himself. And so the Great Eye's prophecy, of course, is fulfilled for him as well, that what the Great Eye said was true, but the Lizard King misunderstood it. And when they get to the castle, the men who are working for the Lizard King at first, they want to surrender, but they feel like they can't. They feel like redemption is beyond them. And so that's why, you know, I have them be told that, no, you know, Lewis, right? And they do. And they would think that that guy, Lewis, is so much better than they are. And they would be ashamed to be in the same room as him. And he says, well, do you realize he just, you know, tried to kill John? And they're shocked to hear that, right? Because to them, Lewis is a good guy. And so the point is everybody, you know, can succumb to moments of weakness. And the community needs to have mercy and forgiveness for those who are sincerely sorry for what they did, and that's the way you can defeat the Lizard King. So notice what I did there. The Lizard King ultimately didn't want to be saved, right? To him, it was too painful. He had committed too many crimes or sins, and so it was just too painful, the process of him coming back, and so he just chose to end it. Whereas his minions, they weren't so far gone that they could still taste, you know, freedom and being back on team good, let's say, right? So not that they're going to be perfect from the rest of their lives, but they could be at least on the right side. But they knew they had chosen poorly beforehand. But again, it took someone reaching out and offering forgiveness and understanding in order to bring them over. So notice that was the way that the bad guys were conquered in this story, is the lower level ones were forgiven when they had expressed sincere regret and they came over. And then ultimately, that was even still the same approach taken with the top dog. It's just, in his case, it didn't work. They couldn't save him because he didn't want to be saved. So I don't want this to go too much longer, but that's partly some new theological views that I've been exploring lately about the nature of hell and what's happening there. And I'll come back to this in future podcast episodes, but saying that it's not so much that God is saying, oh, you were bad during your life and you didn't accept Jesus, so now I'm going to just torture you forever. It's more along the lines of, you need to recognize the depths of your sin and what you did. Like, you need to know, right? So you know how people during their lives, they're like, oh, geez, why, God? Why this? Why that? And people say, don't worry. There's a plan. One day we'll all understand. And that's supposed to be a good thing. But what happens if, when you see the plan, you realize, oh, the reason God had to do X, Y, and Z that seemed incomprehensible at the time is because look at all the sins everybody was committing. And he's like playing defense and doing what he has to do in order to retain our free will, but yet to mitigate the damage. Or, you know, I'm obviously, these are really deep issues. And so I'm probably saying things that aren't quite right, but I hope you get the spirit of what I'm saying. And then you realize, oh, and you see your own role in that. You see how much suffering you caused. And that would be unbearable. That would be hell to be hit with that, unless you've been training your whole life saying, I deserve hell. I am a sinner. You know, I'm a filthy rag compared to the righteousness of Christ. And but my salvation comes not from my own merit, but because of what the work he did on the cross. And when God looks at me, he sees his son because I have faith in him. You know, if you've been training yourself along those lines, you can bear it to actually be confronted with the magnitude of your own sin and the suffering you've caused. Okay. So I'm toying with this now, but I'm saying, suppose it's things like that. All right. Last thing I want to mention here is there's a sense in which the great I orchestrates all of this. Okay. And I don't, again, for those of you who read the story, you know what I'm saying. I'm just pointing it out in case you hadn't thought it through. So just consider that and how the great I was sort of playing both sides, if you will, as opposed to the great I being like in the camp of the good people and saying, whoa, there's that bad thing over there. And who knows, you know, he must be taking advice from somebody. That's not what's going on here. Like the great I is in charge. The great I is good, but the great I is in charge. And this is a higher understanding on my part, at least, of like God and the devil. Like in the Bible, in the book of Job, you know, the devil has to get permission from God to do what he does to Job. That's how the story starts. And I remember when I was younger, that seemed weird to me. That seemed like kind of creepy. Like, what the heck? But it's better that God's in charge, right? I mean, that it does make more sense that, no, God is absolutely in charge. And, you know, it's not that there's this epic battle that, oh, geez, I hope the good guys win. I mean, no, God's omnipotent. Of course he's going to win. That's not even an issue. Also, Jeremiah 27:6, God refers to his servant Nebuchadnezzar. And that's not because he's a servant in the same way that, like, you know, Samuel is his servant or something. So God says, this is the ESV, now I have given all these lands in the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and I have given him also the beasts of the field to serve him. Okay, so here again, the idea is just God is sovereign and he wants certain things to happen in the world. And so he might use people as vessels, even though they would not consider themselves to be followers obedient to the will of Yahweh. Okay, so that's what's going on there. Last thing is G.K. Chesterton, his novel, The Man Who Is Thursday, A Nightmare, has been described as a metaphysical thriller. And so if you like this story, I would encourage you to go check out that one. And that was the example from fiction where I was like, oh, I see now this idea. Again, what I did here with the great eye and how there's a sense in which he was in charge of both sides, that happens in this G.K. Chesterton story as well. And then also in the Chronicles of Narnia, you don't see it in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There it does look like the standard. You got the good guys on one side and Aslan's their leader, and you got the bad guys on the other side and the witch is their leader, and then they're going to have a big epic battle at the end. But later on, you see this more, and you see that there's a sense in which Aslan allows the bad people to do what they do because it serves some higher purpose. So again, let me be clear. It's not that God does evil things, but it's that he allows them to happen because they end up fulfilling his will. All right. So I know it's an important difference, and this is not the place to get into a real theological discussion. And right now I'm not properly equipped to do so, but I'm just pointing this out that it's really not like Optimus Prime versus Megatron. That's not the right way to think about it, because they're close in abilities. Yeah, Optimus Prime is better, but you know, they're having an actual battle, whereas the battle between good and evil it's more like God is on top looking down on it, just telling his story and teaching us something from that, as opposed to God as one of the combatants. And geez, we hope the good guys win. Let's keep our fingers crossed, you know. Okay, well, that's a good place to wrap it up. I hope you enjoyed the story. Again, if you haven't gotten it and for some reason you listen to this, go to bobmurphyshow.com/lizard to get your copy. And I will see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.